Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is November 29th. And we're going to finish up a respiratory chapter today. Turn the lights down. Hopefully you can see the projectors pretty well. Oh, guess what I want to do? I probably want to do this. Okay, that works for me. And we're on the mechanics of breathing. And remember, how is pressure and volume related to each other? What's the relationship between pressure and volume? Is it directly related or inversely related? Inversely related. That's a really good guess. Okay, unless you knew that, congratulations. That's good. Inversely related. So if we think of a volume like the thoracic cavity, as the volume of the thoracic cavity gets larger, what happens to pressure inside the thoracic cavity? If it's inversely related, it goes down. And remember, air is a fluid, and it's going to flow according to what? A pressure gradient. And it's going to flow from high pressure to low pressure, so use diffusion and concentration gradient as a model. All right, so here is just a plain film of the thoracic cavity, and in particular, really what we see here are the volume of the lungs, because there's air in lungs. And so x-rays penetrate that very easily, not so much the heart and the mediastinum. So you can see an outline of the diaphragm right here. So this is a picture of the volume of the lungs before inspiration, and then after inspiration, here is a plain film of the thoracic cavity with the lungs filled up with air. All right, and so you can see that there, what happens to the volume of the thoracic cavity or the pleural cavities on inspiration? Does it get larger or smaller on inspiration? So here is expiration, here is inspiration. The volume is larger, okay, and when that happens, the pressure inside the thoracic cavity decreases, so air flows into the lungs on inspiration because the volumes of the thorax and the pleural cavities increases. All right, so that's a pretty nice picture that shows that. All right, so there are two kinds of breathing that you should be aware of. There's quiet breathing and then forced breathing. Quiet breathing, which we're going to talk about first, inspiration, all right, is mostly due to the contraction of the diaphragm. So here's the diaphragm. It's nice and dome-shaped when it's relaxed, and when it contracts, it flattens out. And so the volume of the thoracic cavity increases by this much right here just due to the contraction of the diaphragm. And as the volume of the thorax increases, what happens to pressure inside the lungs? It decreases, so air flows into the lungs when the diaphragm contracts. Right, the parasternals and external intercostals contribute just a little bit by raising the rib cage, both laterally and anteriorly, but not very much with quiet breathing. And the way that you're breathing right now is quiet breathing, right? Because you're not exercising. And for quiet breathing, expiration is sort of interesting because, remember, the diaphragm has elastic properties. There are elastic proteins in the diaphragm. So when the diaphragm relaxes from a contracted position, so contracted, it's going to be flat. And when the diaphragm relaxes, what happens to it? It stretches back out, okay, and it forms more of this dome shape. And so the volume of the thoracic cavity decreases. That pressurizes air inside the lungs above atmospheric pressure. So which way is air going to flow when the diaphragm relaxes and goes back to this dome-shaped condition right here? It goes out as a result of that, right? So when the volume of the thoracic cavity decreases, increasing the pressure inside the pleural cavity, then air is going to flow out. Okay, there's another thing too. And remember, we talked about the elastic proteins around each alveolus. So when we relax, right, when we start to exhale, the alveoli collapse because of the elastic properties around the alveolus. So expiration is just passive due to recoil of the elastic properties of the alveolus and the diaphragm. So for quiet breathing, inspiration is active, but expiration is passive just due to elastic properties. Now for forced breathing or deep breathing, it's a little bit different. You need to move more air more quickly in and out of the lungs when you're exercising. So that means that there are going to be different muscle groups that are going to be involved, like the scalenes and pectoralis major, even the sternocleidomastoids, okay? Because that's going to elevate the rib cage When these contract, that will help elevate the rib cage, and even the external intercostals will be working more forcefully under deep breathing conditions. And so when it increases the thoracic volume, that decreases the pressure that's going to increase the flow of air into the lungs. And for deep breathing, expiration is quite a bit different. It's no longer passive. It's going to require muscles to compress the thoracic cavity, like the internal intercostals will pull the rib cage down, both laterally and anteriorly. And then also abdominal muscles, and here I see the rectus abdominis, but you have some other abdominal muscles. Who can remember some names of some other abdominal muscles besides the rectus abdominis? Like the external oblique, right? And transverse abdominis. Yeah, so there are four groups of muscles. When they contract, that pressurizes all the abdominal contents and forces them up into the diaphragm, right, which further decreases the thoracic volume, which increases pressure, which helps you with exhalation. So abdominal muscles are important for exhalation during deep breathing. And so on this graph right here, you see muscles of inspiration on the left-hand side, muscles of expiration for deep breathing in particular on the right-hand side over here. All right, so remember, quiet breathing is for expiration is passive, but for forced breathing or deep breathing, then you recruit a bunch of muscles in the abdominal compartment as well as the internal intercostals for exhalation. All right, this slide was replaced because it's got some wrong numbers on it right here, so you should probably just cross it off. Hopefully next semester I'll remember to delete it. And here is the correct one. All right, this one has the correct numbers. And so we have a number of different conditions. At rest, we see a picture of lung volume, and we got some pressure measurements. Then during inspiration and expiration, we can see volume changes of the lungs and pressure changes in the intrapulmonary pressure and intrapleural pressure and atmospheric pressure. So we're going to look at these three circumstances. And what's a typical kind of pressure for atmospheric pressure? This is just a standard atmospheric pressure day in and day out is going to average right around 760 millimeters of mercury, right? And that's going to be constant. We can't change atmospheric pressure. That's just going to be constant. All right, so at rest, the pressure inside the lungs or the intrapulmonary pressure is going to be 760 millimeters of mercury, and I'm just going to say 760. So what's the pressure gradient for moving air in and out of the lungs when that happens? So if the intrapulmonary pressure is 760 and atmospheric is 760, which way is air going to move? Nowhere, because there's no pressure gradient, right? So the lungs will be stationary. Now the intrapleural pressure, the pressure, right, in the pleural space that's filled with pleural fluid right here, is 756. What does that mean? That means that since the intrapulmonary pressure right here is 760 and the intrapleural pressure is below that, the lungs are going to be attached to the pleural membrane or tightly attached to the wall of the thorax. All right, so the lungs won't collapse when that happens, right? They can't collapse even though there's elastic tissue inside the lungs that is trying to collapse the lungs. As long as this intrapleural pressure is less than the intrapulmonary pressure, the lungs are going to be expanded in the thoracic cavity, which is good. All right, now under certain circumstances, if somebody has a hole placed in their thoracic cavity and it interrupts, right, it moves into the pulmonary space right here, right, that's going to suck some air into the pleural space so that atmospheric pressure and the intrapleural pressure will be the same, then that's going to collapse the lung. What do we call that condition? Anybody know what that's called? When this lung collapses, when this pulmonary space, right, has a hole in it to the outside world, that's called a pneumothorax, right? And because then this negative pressure goes away and there's nothing holding the lungs open under those circumstances. Don't forget the elastic properties of the lungs. All right, so here we have the diaphragm kind of dome-shaped. On inspiration, the diaphragm contracts, right, and maybe some other muscles aid in that. Like the external intercostals will elevate the rib cage anteriorly and laterally as well. So the volume increases inside the lungs. So let's look at the change in pressure. It was 760. Now it goes down to 757. And is that above or below atmospheric pressure? It's below, right? So that's just due to Boyle's law that says that volume is inversely related to pressure. So now you have low pressure inside the lungs, so which way is air going to flow? From outside to inside, okay? And that's not a very big pressure change, but what can you tell me about lung tissue? What's that one key word, one concept that explains how the lung changes shape when it experiences changes in pressure? It was compliance, right? And the lungs are highly compliant, so when there's a small change in pressure, there's a large change in volume. And I think I showed you the plastic bag versus the balloon, right? I blew it really hard into the paper bag, and it hardly changed shape. But if I blew really hard into the balloon, what happened to the balloon? Same pressure, it changes shape a lot because a balloon is more compliant. Same thing for the lungs, they're highly compliant. Okay. Then when it's time to exhale, the diaphragm goes back to its original position. It goes back up, okay? And maybe some abdominal muscles contract and extenuate the distension of the diaphragm. So the volume of the lungs decreases. What happens when you squeeze down on a balloon filled with air? What happens to the pressure? It goes up. Same thing with pressure inside the lungs. Let's look at the diagram to see if indeed that's the case. So the volume decreases. Hopefully you can appreciate there's a change in volume. And here's the pressure. Now the pressure, the intrapulmonary pressure is now 763, and is that above or below atmospheric pressure? That's above atmospheric pressure, right? So air leaves the lungs. But you still have 757 millimeters of mercury in the interpleural space right here. So what does that help do? That helps attach the lungs, right, to the walls of the thoracic cavity so they don't collapse completely, right? Okay, so that's always important. This intrapleural pressure should always be less than the intrapulmonary pressure, so the lungs will be attached to the thoracic wall when that happens. Okay, well, it's really important to know something about lung volumes, right, because when you have oxygen inside your lungs, and of course it can be exchanged with the tissue demands for oxygen, and we can measure pulmonary volumes or lung volumes with a scientific study called spirometry. That's just a method of looking at lung volumes, including the anatomic dead space, which is just the volume of air that is in your larynx and your trachea and bronchioles. And remember, there are no alveoli in those structures, so exchange doesn't take place. All right, so no gas exchange takes place in these anatomic dead spaces. So we can measure all of these things. So here is a really good exam figure that you got to know. Every physiology book has this diagram. So this is just something that, like many things in this class, you should just remember for what? The rest of your life. Okay? Okay, so if you can't remember it, then you've got to start drawing it out. So a typical lung volume is just less than 6 liters of air. In a normal size person, about 5,700 milliliters, okay? And because a cc is what? That's a milliliter, that's a cubic centimeter, that's just a milliliter, all right? So that's the total lung capacity, just under 6 liters of air. And when we inspire and expire, breathe in and breathe out, we call that the tidal volume. That's not at the top of the lung volume, at the bottom of the lung volume, that's pretty much right smack in the middle. Right, maybe just a little bit below the middle. And that tidal volume is about 500 mLs typically, but you can see air going in, air going out. That's normally what we breathe in during quiet breathing. But sometimes we're not just sitting, listening to lecture, taking notes. Sometimes we actually exercise every once in a while. And so to get oxygen in, this volume has to change. All right, and if from the bottom of a normal expiration, if you force as much air out of your lungs as possible, we call that the expiratory reserve volume. All right, if you go, and I was at the end of a tidal volume, I just expelled some air from my lungs. All right, we call that expiratory reserve. But notice that if there is some residual volume, you can't completely empty your lungs. Because why? Because that intrapulmonary pressure is negative. It's going to be attached to your thoracic wall. The only way to get all the air out of your lungs is to have a big elephant or rhinoceros or something come and sit on your chest and flatten it out. And then in that case, right, there won't be any air left in your lungs. right? But in normal circumstances, there will be some air left in the trachea and the larynx, bronchioles, and spaces like that. And we call that air that can never leave your lungs the residual volume. Okay. All right, but if at the end of a normal inspiration, what can you do? Hopefully you still have some capacity in your lungs to inflate. So you take a normal breath in, and what can you do? Even inhale a lot more air into your lungs. We call that the inspiratory reserve volume. Kind of that's analogous to the expiratory reserve volume. And so when you need to hyperventilate during exercise, that's a way to, what, increase exchange and the amount of oxygen that's available to your tissues to produce ATP. All right, so we got tidal volume, expiratory, and inspiratory reserve volume, residual volume. So what are the what volumes can you control with your respiration, with your conscious breathing? You can adjust your inspiratory reserve volume to the maximum, right? And your tidal volume, you can breathe more shallowly or deeply, and your expiratory reserve right here. So if we add all of these spaces up together, we get a construct in our mind that we call a capacity, right? So capacity is when you add one or more of these volumes together, and we call that the vital capacity. So vital capacity is the sum of inspiratory reserve, expiratory reserve, and tidal volume. All right, and when you experience lung disease, that vital capacity has a tendency to disappear. All right, so maybe as you get pulmonary disease, this tidal volume moves higher and higher and higher and higher up toward this total lung capacity right here until such time maybe your pulmonary function is so bad because of the anatomy of the lung that your tidal volume is even bumping right up against the total lung volume. So you can hardly exhale any air. If you can't exhale, then you can't inhale either. All right, so then what happens if this residual volume takes over all of your total lung volume to where your tidal volume is way up over here, then what can we do for somebody? A lung transplant. That's what you need because there's no way of repairing, and maybe even a heart and lung transplant at that particular time. Okay, so this tidal volume should just be in this region right here, and you should have normal inspiratory reserve and expiratory reserve volume. So those are the volumes that I'm most interested in and vital capacity, all right? Not so much with the inspiratory capacity and functional residual capacity, but the ones that we just talked about in class. And don't forget about this residual volume. Okay, so we talked about this table right here already. So let's talk about some factors that affect gas exchange. So we have to know something about the solubility of different gases and fluids inside your body and different ways of thinking about it. All right, partial pressure is the pressure that one kind of gas will exert, right, in a container compared to all the other gases that are in that mixture. Right, we can think of them independently of each other. All right. Think of partial pressure maybe as almost like being the concentration of a solute in a solution. You can use that model in your mind pretty effectively. And we got another law right here called Dalton's Law, and it states that the total pressure of a gas in some container is just the sum of all the partial pressures of each gas in that particular mixture. All right. So you can think of the pressure of a gas as being like a solution, and it's made up of all these different kinds of particles. Well, what are some things that we find in air? Okay, these are the major compounds. There's nitrogen. So if we want to know the total pressure within the atmosphere, we need to find out the atmospheric pressure just for nitrogen. But there's also some oxygen. We should need to know what the partial pressure of oxygen is in that mixture. There is some CO2, but CO2 is almost zero. It's really close to zero in the atmosphere, which is a really handy thing. Why is that a really handy thing? What does your body do with CO2? Yeah, you want it out of your body, right? So if you have high CO2 inside your body and it's almost zero in the atmosphere, which way is it going to move? It's going to move out in a big way, right? Just due to the partial pressure difference between those two places. Think of it like a concentration gradient. And then water vapor also will participate. So when water evaporates from its liquid form to a gas form, it contributes according to Dalton's law and produces some pressure. Right? So all of these right here have to add up to 760 millimeters of mercury. Okay, so here is a nice alveolus. And what's the function of an alveolus right here? What does an alveolus have in order to promote its function? Its function is for exchange, right? And because it's surrounded by capillaries. And what's the surface area? If we were to add up all the surface area of all the 300 million alveoli in our lungs, what would the surface area be? We talked about that. Yeah, it's what, 80 square meters? I think that's coming back to me. 80 square, oh no, that's a small intestine. 70, I forgot what it was. I remember what it is in real life. It's what, the surface area of half of a tennis court. Okay, whatever that is. Maybe that is 70 square meters. Okay, so that's the doorway for exchange. All right, but other things that affect exchange is the difference in partial pressure across the respiratory membrane. All right, so here we see CO2 in the atmosphere is about 0.3 millimeters of mercury. It's 40 millimeters of mercury inside the alveolus. So that's a nice concentration gradient to get rid of CO2 from your body. All right, inspired air, oxygen partial pressure is 159. It's only 105 in the alveolar air, so that's a nice concentration gradient. And nitrogen is going to be about the same. These numbers all add up to be equal because, right, when you breathe air into your body, it becomes 100% saturated with water. It's humidified, so the partial pressure of water vapor increases. So here we see a nice alveolus, something missing from the slide. Okay, we see capillaries nicely, but what are we missing? If you can flash back to your anatomy textbook, had a really nice diagram of one component right here, which is necessary for normal breathing. What can you tell me about expiration? Is it active or passive? Here's a hint. It's passive due to what? Expiration for quiet breathing is passive due to what properties of the diaphragm and the alveolus right here? The elastic properties. So what's missing on this alveolus right here are all the elastic fibers. You could draw them in and just say, oh, don't forget about those elastic fibers, right? Which is important for normal expiration. All right, so don't forget when we add the surface area up of all these different alveoli, it's a huge doorway for exchange. All right, the other thing right here, are these bronchi or bronchioles? Bronchi or bronchioles? And just use an anatomical description to tell me why it's so. Okay? I see smooth muscle, but I don't see any cartilage. Okay, so remember, the larynx has cartilage, trachea has cartilage, bronchi have cartilage, but bronchioles do not. Bronchioles, right, the cartilage has been exchanged for what in a bronchiole? Has been exchanged for smooth muscle, right? And these smooth muscles can contract, and it controls airflow to different parts of the lung. That's going to be an important consideration in a little bit. And then we can see some alveolar pores, right? So this looks like a pretty normal lung right here. All right, the rate of blood flow through the pulmonary circuit. Well, how many circuits are there? Make sure this is kind of a change in topic a little bit because we're talking about respiration. Now we jump to cardiovascular system. How many circulatory systems do you have in your body? All right, how many sides do you have to the heart? You got two sides to the heart. That means you have two circulations, and they are the pulmonary circulation and systemic circulation. So we're going to kind of focus on the relationship a little bit between these circulations in here for on this particular slide. But since these circulations run back to back, just think of it as one big long tube, the amount of blood flowing through the systemic circulation has to be the same as the amount flowing through the pulmonary circulation to get back to the heart. If the flow through systemic circulation is a lot greater than the pulmonary circulation, what happens? It backs up in the pulmonary circulation someplace, right? So for a normal individual, the circulation has to be equal. I've mentioned that a couple times in the class. All right, but because the pulmonary circulation is so short, the resistance is a lot less, that means that in order to maintain the same flow, the pressure doesn't have to be as great in the pulmonary compared to the systemic. And on average, it's about 15 millimeters of mercury in the pulmonary circulation, pulmonary arteries, but on the systemic artery, like the aorta, remember the average is about 100. You know, 120 over 80 kind of averages out to about 100 millimeters of mercury. So it's not 15 millimeters of mercury less, it's absolutely 15 millimeters of mercury, which is what? Minuscule compared to the systemic circulation. And that's because the pulmonary vascular resistance is very low. Low pressure is handy because if there's low pressure in the capillaries, that means that less fluid is forced out of the capillaries. That prevents edema from developing inside the lungs. So your lungs have a tendency not to fill up because the pressure, the blood pressure inside the lungs is so low. That's a really handy thing because you don't want fluid in your lungs. What do you really want in your lungs? You want air in your lungs, right? So that's a really important thing. Okay. And so here is something really strange that I want to even go over on the board a little bit. Pulmonary arterioles constrict. Remember those smooth muscles around? Those are smooth muscles around bronchioles, which regulate airflow, but there are smooth muscles around arterioles, right, for blood flow, where alveolar oxygen is low and dilate where it's high. This matches ventilation to perfusion. All right, so why do I find this really interesting and fascinating, something you should ponder? Let's look at this circulation right here. Here I got a nice muscle. What muscle does this look like? Biceps brachii. Okay, that's good. All right, rectus femoris, I don't care. Any kind of skeletal muscle. All right, so what circulatory system is bringing blood to the skeletal muscle right here? Yeah, that's the systemic circulation. Ah, look, here's nice left ventricle. Blood goes in. What do we call this vessel? That's an artery, right? Here we got a vein going back. Oh, look, to the right chamber on the right heart. That's one wonderful. What do we got here? Capillary for exchange. Here's a smooth muscle around an arteriole that controls blood flow through this capillary bed. All right, so let's exercise this muscle. So it's going to start exercising. What's going to happen to oxygen in this muscle when it exercises? All right, so that muscle is going to use up oxygen, so oxygen decreases when it's exercising. What else? Think of some other chemical compounds. Lactic acid. What about lactate? What happens to lactate when this muscle starts to exercise? It goes up. So what happens to pH of this muscle when it exercises? It goes down. What about CO2? If CO2 goes up. Okay, so CO2 is going to go up. And these compounds, now think in this microscopic area right here where the capillary is, these molecules right here will have an effect on this muscle. And what is the what is the effect on this smooth muscle, this sphincter controlling blood flow? You can even think of it as a precapillary sphincter. Okay, what's going to happen to the smooth muscle right here? When pH goes down or CO2 goes up or lactic acid goes up, it's going to inhibit this muscle, right? So it's going to dilate, and when it dilates, what happens to blood flow? It goes up, and it protects the metabolism of this muscle. We call this phenomena local control. It has nothing to do with the autonomic nervous system. This muscle responds just to the chemicals that are being produced, right, or required by this muscle to do its job. Local control. So it's not reflex activity. Okay, so when oxygen is down, this smooth muscle relaxes, increasing perfusion. In what kind of circulation? Systemic circulation. Yeah, question.
Yeah, okay, so if we did not have lactic acid actually, working against our muscles, could we, in theory, just keep on going then, or would something happen with our muscles?
Well, there would still be an increase in CO2. Well, if you didn't, and if there wasn't, then you wouldn't have ATP being produced. Okay, because remember, Krebs cycle produces CO2. You can't produce ATP. And if you can't produce ATP, that muscle is going to stop functioning. So you can't keep on going. So the reason why you're able to keep going is because these biochemicals are being produced and used up. So if these don't change, then you're not making ATP and the muscle is not going to be able to do its job. All right, so it's kind of like a no-win situation. All right, so here is one circulation in terms of local control. Let's look at local control for the other circulation. Which one is this? Right here. Oh, it starts with the right ventricle, goes back to the left atrium. What circulation is that? That's the pulmonary circulation. And what is one way in your mind that you should compare the systemic circulation with the pulmonary circulation? Pulmonary. Yeah, less pressure. circulation. Okay, wanted to get this in here. High pressure, low pressure under normal conditions, but if I wanted to draw this artery right here, remember this is blood moving away from the heart, what color should I really use? Blue, right? Because it's deoxygenated. What color should I really use for the aorta over here? Red. So when you think of systemic and pulmonary circulations, they're not equal. They're what? They're really kind of opposite to each other. All right, so that's one characterization of the pulmonary circulation. All right, so in this particular case, instead of a muscle, we have the lung right here. And let's just say that we have low oxygen in the lung, and then we have high CO2 inside the lung. What's going to be the effect on this smooth muscle sphincter controlling blood flow to that part of the lung that is low in oxygen and high in CO2? Here's a question. Is there any reason for this blood to go to a part of the lung that's low in oxygen? What is the reason that blood is going to the lung? To pick up oxygen. So if there's a part in the lung that's low in oxygen, there's no reason for blood to go there. All right. So in these conditions, right, if there's a part of the lung that's high in CO2, low in oxygen, that causes constriction here. What is that compared to the systemic circulation? It's the opposite, right? So if you have high CO2, low oxygen here, that causes dilation, but in the pulmonary circulation, it causes constriction. So instead of blood going to this part of the lung, where is it going to go? To another part that is high in oxygen, so that oxygen can be absorbed by the circulatory system. So the local control is opposite in the pulmonary circulation compared to the pulmonary circulation. And that's what this says. Pulmonary arterioles constrict where alveolar PO2 is low and dilate where it's high. That's the opposite compared to the systemic circulation. So you might be wondering, why is that important in terms of disease processes? Has anyone ever heard of sleep apnea? Yeah? Being recognized as a really clinically important condition, and it can be fatal, right? And we didn't really realize this maybe 15, 20 years ago. Why is it such a terrible condition? Okay, for a number of reasons, but let's just consider one of the reasons. When you have sleep apnea, it means that you stop breathing at night when you're asleep. Okay, and when you stop breathing, what happens to CO2 in the lungs? It goes way up, right? What happens to oxygen in the lungs? Goes way down, which is what we have right here. So when CO2 goes up, oxygen goes down, what happens to this smooth muscle right here? It constricts. So now when you have sleep apnea, you don't even have blood being perfused through the lungs. You have this high resistance. But what about the right side of the heart and the left side of the heart? What's the law there? The flow has to be constant, right? Has to remain constant. If the pressure goes way up, I mean if the resistance goes way up, right, but to remain, keep the flow between the right and left side of the heart the same, what does the pressure have to do? It's got to go sky high. Okay, so now the right side of the heart, instead of pumping blood through a low resistance circuit at very low pressures, the blood pressure has to go from 15 millimeters of mercury, maybe up to 50 or 60 or even 100. What do you call that when you have way above normal blood pressure? Hypertension, okay? And hypertension over the long term will kill the heart, and in this particular case, what part of the heart is going to be killed? Not the left ventricle, but the right ventricle, okay? So sleep apnea produces pulmonary hypertension, which is going to kill the right side of the heart, okay? That's just one of the circumstances that happens because of local control of perfusion in the lungs. And if that's not caught and treated and the right side of the heart fails, guess what you need? You need a heart transplant or probably a heart and lung transplant as a result of that. So if you know anybody that chronically snores, might not even know that they have sleep apnea, then they need a sleep study to prevent that from happening. Okay, because nobody wants a heart and lung transplant. All right. I can't tell you that from experience, but I can imagine that pretty easily. Okay, so think of that local control. And the pulmonary local control is what? Opposite compared to the systemic side of the heart. Okay. So this just kind of shows you that even under normal circumstances, the apex of the lung has a more efficient ventilation to perfusion ratio compared to the lower, the more basilar parts of the lung, but that's normal. But if during sleep apnea, then these numbers are going to go sky high. Okay. And it's also going to stimulate the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so anything that is stimulated by the sympathetic nervous system will take place when somebody has sleep apnea, including increase of resistance even on the systemic side. So it will pull, it can even kill the left side of the heart as well. Not to mention that somebody then won't have normal sleep and will feel miserable during the day when that happens. All right, one last question regarding the difference right here. How can you measure systemic blood pressure? Sort of an interesting little correlation. I'll try to relate it to your lab experience a little bit. How do you measure systemic blood pressure? Is it hard or easy to do? Do you have like a drill a hole in the heart and put a pressure transducer in there? No, just a little pressure cuff around the arm, right? And with sphygmomanometry, you can measure systolic and diastolic pressure in the systemic circulation really easily. We could do that 100 times in a lecture period. But what about pulmonary circulation? Where's the pulmonary artery at?
Inside.
Yeah, it's inside. It's coming right off the base of the heart. So if you want to measure pressure in the pulmonary circulation, that's a surgical procedure. It's not done. There's no way to do it easily. So since it's difficult to measure, who's ever measured their pulmonary blood pressure in here? Nobody, right? So we have really no clue. That's why sleep apnea is so dangerous, because it's really hard to measure these pressures, and it can sneak up on somebody and do irreversible damage to the heart before you even know it. Okay, but there's one thing in lab that you did. One thing in lab that you were able to measure something about the right side of the heart, which typically is really hard to do. I don't know, anybody think it? What did you do to measure something about the balance, the position of the heart, the size of the tissue in the right ventricle compared to the left ventricle? You did mean electrical axis of the heart, right? And it's kind of tilted to the left because the heart is tilted to the left inside your chest, but also because the left ventricle is a lot bigger, so the vector, the electrical depolarization vector, is skewed to the left. Guess what happens to mean electrical axis of the heart when the right side has to hypertrophy, get big, to compensate for this big resistance right here that develops during sleep apnea? Then the mean electrical axis of the heart shifts over to the right a little bit, and so that could be maybe an interesting way that somebody could use easily to measure, right, the pulmonary side of the heart to see if the resistance is increasing, or check for pulmonary hypertension non-invasively. Okay, so you guys did that in lab. Did you guys do mean electrical axis of the heart? You still have to do that? No, you did it already, I'm sure. All right, well, let's get back to the respiratory chapter. All right, the part of the brain that's responsible for breathing. You breathe even when you're asleep, even though the diaphragm is a skeletal muscle. All right, there are some automatic kind of functions that happen in the brainstem to make sure that even when you're unconscious, you stay breathing, right? And we call these the respiratory centers. That's in the medulla right here and the pons. The rhythmicity center is in the medulla right here. And so when it's excited, it will stimulate inspiratory neurons that will then cause inspiration. Okay, but the rhythmicity area right here is kind of like under antagonistic control by two nuclei that are in the pons. They're called the apneustic and pneumotaxic center right here. And the way that I think of this is like being the autonomic nervous system. Even though they're not part of the autonomic nervous system, what can you tell me about the autonomic nervous system? How many divisions are there?
Two.
There are two, yeah. And how many centers do you see in the pons right here? There are two. What's the relationship between the different divisions of the autonomic nervous system? They're antagonistic to each other. The same thing for the pneumotaxic and apneustic area right here. All right, so inspiratory neurons stimulate that are in the medulla, okay, the rhythmicity centers, stimulate spinal motor neurons that innervate respiratory muscles. And guess what? You should know probably the most important nerve What's the most important nerve for? Close, but not quite. It's going to a skeletal muscle. Okay, it's going to a skeletal muscle, so it doesn't need autonomic nervous system. It's just a regular old nerve. And the vagus nerve is really what? Parasympathetic nerve. So this is just a typical motor neuron.
What's the name of the muscle?
And the muscle is a diaphragm. And in anatomy, you didn't have to learn a whole big list, but in my classes, I made people know at least one nerve that goes to a skeletal muscle. So usually we don't pay attention much to innervation, except for the diaphragm, because what's going to happen to you if you lose control of the diaphragm? Well, yeah, you're going to croak, right? Because you can't breathe. All right, so what's the name of the nerve that goes to the diaphragm? It's not autonomic nerve. It's just a regular nerve. And it's a spinal nerve. It's the phrenic nerve. I can see why. I can understand why you say vagus, because it's spelled a little differently, but it sounds kind of the same. Phrenic nerve. All right, so the phrenic nerve innervates the diaphragm. And what are the roots of the phrenic nerve? It goes through the cervical plexus. So that you should probably know. Yeah, just remember what? C3, 4, 5 keeps you alive. That's the origin of the phrenic nerve. All right, but don't forget, expiration is just passive. That's when the inspiratory neurons are inhibited. And when they're inhibited, the muscles relax. Then what happens for quiet breathing? The diaphragm goes back because of elastic properties, and then expiration takes place. All right, so the rhythmicity center is influenced by something that's very similar to what the architecture of the autonomic nervous system is. The apneustic center promotes inspiration by stimulating, right, the rhythmicity center. The pneumotaxic center antagonizes the apneustic center, thus inhibiting inspiration. All right, so think of these two as being antagonistic to each other, and therefore it's going to adjust the rate and depth of inspiration as a result of that. Okay, so if somebody has a lesion in this part of the brain stem and the pons, in particular these areas right here, or the rhythmicity center, then they lose this automatic control of inspiration. So how is it that they take a breath then? If this area right here is damaged, maybe due to a stroke or maybe some kind of other metabolic scarring in these areas right here, they lose the automatic ability to breathe. It's not really autonomic, it's just an automatic ability to breathe. How is it that they breathe? Just like every time you contract the biceps muscle, what is that under the control of? Your conscious thought. Okay, so they can only breathe when they're awake, okay, and consciously thinking about breathing. How tedious would that be? So that's really unfortunate when that happens. That's called Odin's curse. That syndrome is called Odin's curse. And I can tell nobody is on a respirator in here, so nobody has Odin's curse. So when you sleep, you have to be on a machine that breathes for you. That's all there's to it.
Why call it Odin's curse?
Why Odin's curse? I'll tell you after class. Okay. Because I don't want to take time. It's sort of interesting, but I'll take time later. Because I want to try to get through this chapter. It's a wonderful question, though. It's kind of fun. You could Google it. Don't Google it now, though. I don't want to see any smartphones clicking away right now. Okay. So the different centers in the medulla are influenced by the chemistry inside your body, like oxygen and carbon dioxide. Okay. So things that measure chemicals inside your body are called chemoreceptors, right? Are chemoreceptors. They can measure CO2 and oxygen and pH. Of these, what do you think is most important for regulating your respiration? Okay. For years and years before I studied physiology, I thought for sure it was oxygen. Because what do you need oxygen for? Making ATP. Makes perfect sense. But you know what? That is not it. The most important chemical is carbon dioxide, all right, which is a byproduct of cellular respiration. All right, so automatic breathing, notice it doesn't say autonomic, it just says automatic. All right, is influenced by the concentrations of these various chemicals right here. Oh, what is pH? What's it a measure of? Hydrogen ion concentration, right? So hydrogen or acidity, but hydrogen ion concentration, so that's a chemical, so you need a chemoreceptor. There are central chemoreceptors that are in the medulla, which is really nice and handy because that's where your respiratory center is located at. But there are some peripheral chemoreceptors that are close to the heart, chemoreceptors in the arch of the aorta, and then also the carotid sinus right here. So not only are there baroreceptors in these locations, especially the carotid sinus, but there are chemoreceptors for these chemical compounds. All right, so here is kind of a flow diagram of how breathing, automatic breathing, is regulated. So you have the medulla oblongata, which contains the basic rate for inspiration, but the pons can send signals to modify that rate depending on whether the apneustic center or pneumotaxic center is stimulating or inhibiting the rhythmicity center in the medulla oblongata. But the chemoreceptors also send information to the medulla oblongata. So that is the, what do we call this in a response loop? This is the integration center, right? The integration center. And it makes a decision on what to do with all this information, right? Including the cerebral cortex, because we could do an experiment right now. We could bypass all of this by just holding our breaths. I've never done this in class, but I got to do it one of these semesters. We should all just hold our breath until we pass out. Okay, that would be cool. And all the, and film it, just everybody pass out. But then you don't have to worry about that, because as soon as you pass out, then what, the automatic breathing centers will take over, supposedly, and everybody will be back to normal. Because these different chemical compounds are going to build up. What's going to build up when you hold your breath, when you pass out? The CO2 is going to build up, right? And then the medulla oblongata is going to take over, then send signals down through the spinal cord to at least, to what regions of the spinal cord are these going to exit? C3, 4, and 5, right? Those are the origins of the phrenic nerve, and that is going to go primarily to the diaphragm. Okay, so what chemicals are going to be working? All right, so CO2, oxygen, and pH. Let's talk about CO2 first. It's the most crucial, okay, because of the following reaction right here. CO2 can combine with water to make carbonic acid, and carbonic acid can then dissociate into hydrogen ion and bicarbonate, right? And there is an enzyme that facilitates this conversion. The Gibbs free energy is about zero, right? So the free energy of these compounds is equal. There's no change. So what can you tell me about the reversibility of this reaction? Freely reversible. And that's why you see this arrow is being double-ended right here. Okay, and it's really fast because of that enzyme that we call carbonic anhydrase. All right, so when CO2 builds up in your body, what happens to pH? Yeah, pH plummets. It becomes very acidic, right? So you can change the pH of your body by hyperventilating or by hypoventilating. If you hyperventilate, you get rid of a lot of CO2. And then the reaction is going to be forced to the left. Bicarbonate will combine with hydrogen ion, and that's going to increase the pH inside your body. We call that a respiratory alkalosis. If you hold your breath, that will put you into a respiratory acidosis. All right, so we're all really alien because our breath contains a lot of CO2, and in your body, what does that produce? Acid. So every time we exhale, we're exhaling a lot of acidity from our body, all right? Not enough to like burn a hole in a spaceship armor plating or something like in the movie Aliens, but nonetheless, a lot of acid is excreted just by breathing in our body. So hyperventilation causes low CO2. We call that hypocapnia, and hypoventilation, which is decreased holding your breath, that produces hypercapnia that relates to CO2 right here, which then changes the acidity of your body, even fairly drastically, because of the carbonic anhydrase reaction right here. All right, so increased arterial CO2, maybe due to exercise or holding your breath. So plasma CO2 increases, and that blood goes to the brain. And because of the carbonic anhydrase reaction, CO2 can enter the brain, and it's going to decrease the pH of interstitial fluid inside the brain, and chemoreceptors will notice that decrease in pH, and that's going to stimulate the respiratory center and stimulate the diaphragm to contract, right? So that's going to increase ventilation. What's that going to do? How's that going to feed back to increases in arterial PCO2? If you increase ventilation, what happens to CO2 in your blood? It's going to go back down. So here's a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right. There are also chemoreceptors in the aortic arch and carotid bodies, right, which will also stimulate when blood pH goes down, will stimulate the respiratory center and respiratory muscles, increasing ventilation. So again, that's a nice negative feedback loop right here. And so CO2 is the most important compound for regulating ventilatory rate because of its effect on pH in the body. And why does CO2 concentration have an effect on pH inside your body? What's the name of the reaction? We call it the carbonic anhydrase reaction as a result of that. Okay, so that's freely reversible. All right, so the brain chemoreceptors are responsible, are the most responsible receptors for regulating ventilation. Hydrogen ions can't cross the blood-brain barrier because it's a cation. All right, but CO2 can. CO2 can scoot across membranes very easily, right? And so the rate and depth of ventilation is adjusted by the integration center so that you have a pCO2 of about 40 millimeters of mercury, okay, in arteries. And peripheral chemoreceptors don't respond to pCO2, only to hydrogen ions, which makes sense because hydrogen ions can't get into the brain, so CO2 is monitored. But the peripheral receptors are right there in the blood, so they can measure pH very easily. So I think this is an exam figure. Here we have the brain, the medulla oblongata. That's the rhythmicity center right here. So here are neurons that have chemoreceptors for hydrogen ions. And then we have a little cerebrospinal fluid. This is like interstitial space inside the brain. Then here's the blood-brain barrier. Anybody remember the name of the cells that help make the blood-brain barrier right here? They're kind of neuroglia. It's an astrocyte, okay? Just kind of fun to think about. You still remember some of your anatomy a little bit. Then here we have a capillary. Of course, capillaries allow for exchange. CO2 can move from high concentration to low concentration in the brain, right? So CO2 can move through the blood-brain barrier, but what about hydrogen ions? Can't get across the blood-brain barrier, but when CO2 enters the brain, it can produce hydrogen ions by what reaction? The carbonic anhydrase reaction, and when hydrogen ions increase, the pH, of course, decreases. That stimulates these inspiratory centers right here to increase ventilation. All right, so that's the inspiratory center. Low blood oxygen, partial pressures in oxygen, we call that hypoxemia, has little effect on ventilation. Although it has a major effect on how ATP is produced in your body, it's not very important for ventilatory drive, right? But it can influence chemoreceptor sensitivity to carbon dioxide. It makes it more sensitive, so it does help to some degree, right? In order for oxygen to control or have an effect on ventilation, oxygen has to fall to about half normal before ventilation is affected, okay? And one example of this, I have sort of a gruesome example, but it happens, okay? When somebody dies and they stop breathing, okay, the instant they die, their muscles are still functional, and they're still using up oxygen, and we take people off a ventilator, and their oxygen decreases and decreases and decreases, and when it gets up to about half what it is normally in the body, even a dead person will take some very dramatic gasps. And, oh, I just had the name for that in my mind. Anybody have a name for that? It will come back in just a second. And even when somebody's dead, they'll take these gasps for air because oxygen is depleted, and it's really scary, okay? Unless you know something about the respiratory system. Agonal breathing, okay? It's called agonal breathing. When you breathe even after you're dead a couple times, okay? And that's just a normal occurrence because oxygen is decreased to, yeah, it's really scary, okay? Oxygen is decreased in that person's body to such a low level that it stimulates the inspiratory neurons.
Does that have anything to do with, like, sudden, like, jerks or twitches after?
Yeah, probably same thing, yeah. Your body is just trying to breathe because oxygen is depleted so much. So that's what this graph here just kind of describes, the difference in CO2 and oxygen. So here we have ventilatory rate, right, in liters per minute, and on the top we have percent CO2, and on the bottom we have percent oxygen. So as the ventilatory rate, okay, decreases, right, when ventilatory rate decreases, what happens to percent oxygen? As ventilatory rate decreases, here we have oxygen decreasing as we go from left to right, all right. So here is what the oxygen concentration is under normal conditions. And let's just say ventilatory rate doesn't start to increase until it's about what? About half of what it was under normal conditions. So oxygen, changes in oxygen is very insensitive for adjusting ventilatory rate. But what about CO2? Here it is under normal conditions. When ventilatory rate decreases, look at the axis right here. So here we have, instead of decreasing like we do for oxygen, here is increasing CO2 on the top axis. So as the CO2 starts to decrease, what happens to ventilatory rate? It starts to increase almost immediately. All right, so CO2 is the most sensitive chemical in your body for adjusting ventilatory rate, not oxygen. Okay, but nonetheless, without oxygen, you still can't make ATP. This can be kind of, I think this might clarify an example. Are there any free divers here in the room? Any free divers? No? Okay. Free divers are people that go out in the ocean and they hunt for fish with a spear gun. So where do you find fish? Way under the surface, right? So you got to haul your body way down, and you don't wear scuba gear, so you have to hold your breath when you do that. I know a lot of people are shaking their head. It sounds really crazy because I've seen people really, really deep, like 30, 40 feet, that just swim, right, hunting for fish, okay? And of course, when you're underwater, you can't breathe, so you're not getting oxygen. So how is it that you can improve your time that you can submerge? What's the chemical that is going to force you to breathe or give you the urgency to breathe? It's going to be CO2. But you can get rid of CO2 from your body by doing what before you dive? By hyperventilating. You can blow a lot of CO2 off in your body, right? So that will give you a sense that you're okay, right? So you can hyperventilate and dive really, really deep. And then the CO2 then starts to build up a little bit. You'll have a little urgency, but nonetheless, you're still exercising. What is your body using up to stay underwater? Oxygen, okay? But nonetheless, you don't have an urgency to breathe, but your oxygen is being depleted. You can get to a certain point where you're so low on oxygen, your brain can't make ATP, but you still don't have an urgency to breathe because your CO2 was so depressed by hyperventilating, okay? And when your brain runs out of oxygen, what happens? Yeah, you pass out, right? Because your brain can't make ATP, even though you didn't have an urgency to breathe. But now, if you're a free diver, where are you? You're 30 feet underwater, and you pass out. What is the rhythmicity center going to tell your body to do? Better start breathing, okay? But what's going to happen there? Well, then you're just going to be breathing water instead of atmosphere. So that's a really dangerous technique that's used by some people. You can pass out before you even know you're going to pass out if you hyperventilate before you go through that diving exercise. All right, so that's just kind of an interesting exercise to see if you kind of understand how breathing is regulated in your body. All right, well, lung tissue is pretty delicate. It could be possible to overinflate your lungs. And if you overinflate your lungs, you can start to herniate alveoli or rip alveoli and rip the capillaries in your lungs. Fortunately, there are stretch receptors in your lungs. When they are stretched, they then inhibit the respiratory centers and prevent overinflation of the lungs. So under normal circumstances, it's not possible to overinflate your lungs. Maybe if you try really, really hard with a lot of practice, you can do that, but it's difficult. That's called the Herring-Brewer reflex. So Herring-Brewer reflex is a result of a stretch receptor reflex that prevents overinflation because it excites the inhibitory centers in the brain and prevents hyperventilation. All right, let's talk about how carbon dioxide and oxygen are transported in the blood. So that's really a major function of the circulatory system, is to transport these gases. So these gases can dissolve to one degree or another in that fluid, just like sodium and chloride or glucose can dissolve in plasma. All right, but oxygen has a difficult time. It does not like to dissolve in water. So your body needs some help. And that's why you have red blood cells. And red blood cells are loaded with a chemical compound that can bind oxygen, and that chemical is called hemoglobin. All right, so loading of hemoglobin occurs in the lungs, and unloading of oxygen from hemoglobin occurs in tissues. And so hemoglobin delivers oxygen to the tissues. And that affinity of hemoglobin for oxygen changes due to a number of physiologic variables. So we want to look at some of these variables that control the loading of oxygen onto hemoglobin. All right, so here's a hemoglobin molecule. It's got four chains. It's got two alpha chains and two beta chains. And on each one of these chains, that's what the quaternary structure of a protein, right, is when it can form molecules based on different numbers of subunits. And each one of these subunits right here has an iron atom. All right, so here is the iron atom inside in this heme group. And each one of these heme groups can bind one oxygen atom. So that means how many oxygens can bind to one hemoglobin molecule? Can bind four. Okay? All right, so each hemoglobin can carry four oxygens. All right, so let's look and see how that improves the carrying capacity of blood for oxygen. Here's an oxygen bottle, and we adjust the pressure coming out of it so that it's 100 millimeters of mercury, and then we bubble that through this chamber over here that doesn't have any hemoglobin, and then it reaches equilibrium to be, 100 millimeters of mercury right here. And if we measure the oxygen content, how much oxygen is in 100 mLs of blood, we see that there, at standard pressures and temperature, there's 0.3 mLs of oxygen for every 100 milliliters of this fluid right here. We could just call it plasma, right? But it doesn't contain hemoglobin. But if we take that same partial pressure of oxygen and bubble it through whole blood, that does contain hemoglobin. Okay, and it's going to be at the same partial pressure. It will reach equilibrium, just like this chamber over here. All right, can you see more oxygen molecules over here on the right-hand chamber compared to the left-hand chamber? Indeed, which means that hemoglobin allows this blood sample, this blood sample, lost my cursor for a second, to carry more oxygen. And if we measure the amount of oxygen at standard pressures and temperatures, it's going to be 20 mLs for every 100 mL of blood. Okay, so it's a huge amount, 20 times more when somebody has hemoglobin. When oxygen binds to hemoglobin, we call it oxyhemoglobin. And in this particular case, I can see, and every hemoglobin can bind how many oxygen molecules? Four. And every hemoglobin that I see in this chamber over here is completely saturated. So at 100 millimeters of mercury partial pressure of oxygen, basically all the hemoglobin is completely bound up with oxygen, right? It's very efficient. And each red blood cell has almost 300 million molecules of hemoglobin, right? So multiply that by four as to how many molecules of oxygen every red blood cell can carry. Right, so it greatly increases. But other things combine to hemoglobin. Right? Methemoglobin contains a ferric iron instead of the oxidized form. And under certain kinds of poisoning circumstances, a ferrous iron is converted to ferric iron, and that lacks the electron necessary to bind oxygen. And so that decreases the amount of oxygen that can be transported in the blood. Okay, carboxyhemoglobin is when hemoglobin binds with carbon monoxide. What's carbon monoxide? CO, right? It's not CO2, carbon dioxide. And carbon monoxide is produced anytime there is combustion of some kind of carbon fuel, like when you burn a candle or gasoline in your car, carbon monoxide is produced because those reactions are sort of inefficient. They're not controlled by enzymes, so carbon monoxide is a side reaction that takes place. Right, and so carbon monoxide has a much higher affinity for hemoglobin than oxygen does. So, and the factor is 200 times more higher affinity than oxygen. All right, so it's a very terrible poison because when carbon monoxide binds to hemoglobin, then the binding site for oxygen is blocked and hemoglobin can't transport oxygen. And the really only efficient treatment for that is to then subject somebody to really high concentrations or partial pressures of oxygen, and that forces carbon monoxide off of hemoglobin. So if we have a hemoglobin molecule right here, and we've got a CO2 molecule bound to it, how many oxygen molecules do we have to put around this hemoglobin to bump that one carbon monoxide molecule off? All right, how many oxygen molecules do we have to do? So here's an oxygen. Here's another oxygen. Tell me stop. when I've drawn enough right here. Stop. Okay, thank you. Because I would have to draw 210 before you could bump that carbon monoxide. So that just kind of describes how difficult a poisoning that is to treat. And the thing about carbon monoxide is that it's colorless and odorless. And once it binds to hemoglobin, it doesn't like to let go. So very small concentrations of carbon monoxide can build up over time to kill somebody, even when it's below the level of detection. And this is the perfect time of year where these kinds of accidents happen. When somebody's furnace isn't working properly in their house, or somebody brings in a barbecue to heat their house. Doesn't happen in LA too much, but in colder places like Chicago, Minneapolis, all right, we'll probably start hearing about, you know, and every once in a while, like a whole family will get wiped out because a heater in their house starts to misbehave. So it's something not to mess around with. Okay, here we see a table that shows the partial pressure of oxygen, okay, in whole blood, and what the percent binding is, the percent oxyhemoglobin. So as the partial pressure gets to be about 100 millimeters of mercury, right, then all of the hemoglobin mostly is bound up with oxygen. All right, and then in venous blood, the partial pressure decreases to 40 millimeters of mercury, and that then relates to a percent oxyhemoglobin of 75%. So this is the amount of oxygen that is released by hemoglobin to tissues. Okay, and we can calculate what that is in millimeters per mercury. This table is not so interesting, but we could plot one variable against another to find, all right, a saturation curve for hemoglobin and oxygen. Oh, and notice this is at a particular pH of 7.4 and at a temperature of 37 degrees. And you should be really familiar with these two numbers, because what do they relate to? They relate to you, okay? Because your pH of your blood is, what, a little bit basic, and this is your body temperature, 98.8 or whatever it is, okay? But that's in centigrade. So if we plot those out, we get this diagram right here, all right? So this is the hemoglobin saturation curve. As the partial pressure of oxygen increases, what happens to percent oxyhemoglobin? It also increases. It's just not a straight line. It's just a sigmoid curve right here. All right, so after the test, this is where we're going to start. And I see we need two more lectures during finals week. I don't know what I'm going to do. Okay, I can skip some stuff. Okay, but we're going to talk about this. So over the weekend coming up after your test, start to read some things about oxygen saturation curves. So I can get through this quickly so we can get to urinary system. How many slides do I have? Not too many slides left. That's a good thing. Okay, oh, no sign-in sheet today. Sorry about that. Did somebody, one went around? Oh, really good. Sign the sign-in sheet, please.